Lecture 12, The Case Against the World's First Language.
This is a lecture about something which a lot of you may have read about in the media, which is that there have been claims that words from the first language have been discovered. These are claims that come from a small number of linguists, and an issue of the Atlantic Monthly was devoted to it some years ago. It pops up in the New York Times now and then. And the linguists in question, mainly, are Joseph Greenberg of Stanford University. He is now the late Joseph Greenberg, but he was a pioneer in classifying, for example, the languages of Africa. He was a towering figure in terms of other linguistic ideas that he pioneered. But he's probably become best known for the proto-world theory. His legacy is being carried on by Merritt Roulin, who is an independent scholar. And the proto-world hypothesis flutters on the edge of linguistic debate, often dismissed. The work is covered with interest in the media, but most linguists who have examined it have vehemently rejected it. And it's tempting to think, especially as an interested layman, and the way the newspaper stories tend to be pitched, that this is an example of the pioneer, the Ferdinand de Saussure, basically, who has an idea that is promising but not yet proven in a rock-solid way, and all of the blinkered, hide-bound colleagues are incapable of understanding this, incapable of opening up their minds to it, kind of like the man who discovered continental drift, von Wegener, etc. Everybody laughed at him, and then it turned out that the continent's head drifted. Yet, the fact is that if you look at the evidence for proto-world, the fact is that even with your best attempt, and of course what I really mean is my best attempt at an unbiased judgment, it's hard to see things the way Greenberg did and the way Roulin does, at least precisely the way they do. Now, I've been told that in making these tapes that I'm supposed to move around more. So now I'm going to step out here. I'm going to talk from here. I've moved. So, the fact is that as far as Greenberg and Roulin's work goes, despite the fact that I'm disinclined to think of things exactly the way they do, I would also have to say that the response of many linguists to their work has been reflexively contemptuous to a degree that has rather frightened me. And if anything, coming up in the field and watching the faces go red and the body posture get defensive at the very mention of Merritt Roulin or proto-world tipped me off that these guys might be onto something. Usually when people are that upset about it, there's some sort of sense of threat or at least a shattering lack of imagination. So I've tried to look at these things, and I've written here and there about what I thought. This lecture is going to be the critical one. This lecture is going to be what I think the layman should watch out for the next time the New York Times writes about this. The next lecture will be showing what is good about their work and what is promising about their work, some of which has neither made the Times nor reputable linguistics journals, partly because it's hard for Merritt Roulin to get published in reputable linguistics journals, and partly because sometimes I think he hides his light beneath a bushel to an unseemly extent. So this is my attempt to be as fair as possible on this subject. Now, the idea is that there is this handful of words, or I guess it would be several handfuls, or depending on how big your hands are, or whatever, of words that have been reconstructed that are supposedly the first words, the words of Adam and Eve, or whatever you want to call it. And the idea has been that this can be reconstructed by looking at words in hundreds of languages and using those same techniques of deduction that we use with Proto-Indo-European partly, but where written sources don't exist or we only know so much about the language family, just using a kind of an intelligent eyeballing strategy. The idea being, well, it looks like that, well, then probably it comes back to this. And if that's all that you have available, maybe that's what you have to do. But the first problem, the first thing that we have to think about is, let's say that 150,000 years ago, you've got a word. You know, who knows what the word is? Kabibble. Now, given the way words change shape, we've seen our whole snusos to nu issue. Why is it that 150,000 years later, or even 80,000 years later, or whenever you think that language began, why would any word still be recognizable? If you're always having this constant turnover, why would there be any that would kind of sit there like diamonds in the mine? And you have to think about even humble cases, like the word for bread in Spanish is pan, in Russian it's chleb, in Greek it's psomi. And these are related languages in a family where there's only been so much divergence. So why in the world would anything stay? And what we want to demonstrate is an example of this that is something other than Indo-European, because I think it's truly a beautiful thing. Algonquian languages are one group of Native American languages, and they include Cree and also Cheyenne, which is spoken in Montana and Oklahoma. Algonquianists are a subclass of linguists. They've done as much work on reconstruction as Indo-Europeanists have, and they have reconstructed quite a bit of what they call, not Proto-Indo-European, but Proto-Algonquian. And it's a nice compact group of languages. It's a fun field. They have reconstructed that the Proto-Algonquian word for winter was peponwi. So P-E-P-O-N-W-I, peponwi. That's a nice word. Now, the same word in Cheyenne is not something like pebon or something like peony or something like that. It's ah, literally that. It's a long A with a catch in the throat. Ah. So, peponwi, ah. And believe it or not, peponwi became ah step by step, because this is how sound change happens. Only over 1,500 years. These are the steps. So you start with peponwi. Now, things that are hanging at the end, especially when they're vowels, or vowel-y sounds like W and Y, are fragile. So, name begins as name. Well, peponwi first became pepon. That little part dropped off. That's normal. Now, we've seen how H's tend to drop away. Some consonants drop away a lot less than H, but you never know in a language when they're going to gang up on a particular consonant. In some languages, it'll be this consonant that's weak. In some languages, it'll be another. In Proto-Algonquian, there was this strange P problem. And so P's dropped out in particular cases. So, pepon, that was nice. But then after a while, eon, and the P's were gone. And it's pretty easy to see, peponwi, pepon, eon. If you know how that worked, the relationship between peponwi and eon is clear to us, although we're already getting pretty far away. Vowels shift around. Bad, bad. Well, eon, ain. That was the next step. The vowels just move. You know it's not going to stay eon. It became ain. There's that n hanging on the end, and n's are often rather fragile. So, after a while, instead of ain, ai. Some people talked funny and they just said ai. Pretty soon nobody said ain anymore. So, ai. Peponwi, ai. Now, sometimes vowels get longer. In this case, there was a little glottal stop in between. Ai, 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 ai. That was next. And so we start with peponwi, ai. Then that changed to ai. Then that e at the end dropped off. Ah. So, peponwi. So, peponwi, pepon, eon, ain, ai, 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 ai. And there you go. 1,500 years. That's how sound change works. And so now, you read the New York Times, the first words. But if the first word, for example, was peponwi, and then 1,500 years later in a language it can be ah, well then who knows what it's going to be 100,000 years later. So that's the first thing that you have to think about. But getting closer up to what the proto-world people are actually doing, nevertheless they insist. Maybe it's just that certain words do stay pristine. Maybe it's just chance. Maybe it's just the roll of the dice. Not every word is going to be a peponwi. Maybe not. So, for example, one of their most famous reconstructions is that apparently teak, T-I-K, was the original word for one or maybe finger, the idea being that you count one with your finger. And how do they know? Well, you can look at languages of the world, And I suppose that you could detect a certain coalescence around something like teak. So, for example, in Sudan, there's a language called Dinka. Their word for one is tok. Then in Turkish, the word for only, and that's kind of like one, is tek. And then, well, in Old English, the word for toe was tahe. And toe, maybe that's like finger. And then in Japanese, te means hand, which is close to the finger. And then in Southern Tasmanian, if we can trust the documents, the word for forefinger was motuk. And you go on and on like this. In one Eskimo variety, the word for index finger is tiki. And then in Latin, you have digitus. And remember, T and D are related, and K and G are related. So digitus is kind of like saying tikitus. And so maybe there's a tik there, and so on. So you look at all these languages, and there's all this tickness. And you think, well, maybe that traces back to tick. Now, the problem is here that in terms of tracing back, writing has only existed for 6,000 years. I would say language has probably existed for 150,000. Some people would say 50,000. I think they're wrong now. Maybe eventually when they acknowledge that the Big Bang has been misdated, they'll say that it's 80,000, but a very, very long time. 6,000 is a little fraction. Most people would say that if language had only existed for 24 hours, then writing would have been invented after 11 o'clock p.m. So that's how new writing is in terms of language. So if we're going to be tracing back to the very first thing, then we've got an awful lot of non-writing time involved. And so we can't do the very careful comparative reconstruction based on written documents that you can do to get, say, Snusos. Because there, not only do you have Hindi, but then you can go back to Sanskrit, which is basically not truly a spoken language anymore, but we certainly got many written records. Then you've got these proto-languages, and then you can trace back from that another step to this hypothetical language. But here we're going way, way back. Now, Rulin has a very useful objection along these lines. He knows that this is a problem, but he has written that we're expecting too much, that comparative reconstruction of that kind can only go as far back as writing, but that we're being somewhat timid and unimaginative in insisting that that's as far back as we can ever reconstruct anything. And on that, he does have a point. One quote he has, under acknowledged, but which I think is perfectly put, is the following. Were a biologist to demand a complete reconstruction of proto-mammal, together with a complete explanation of how this creature evolved into every living mammal, before he would accept the fact that human beings are related to cats and bats, he wouldn't be taken seriously. Yet, it's just this kind of linguistic nonsense that's been taught in universities by Indo-Europeanists for so long that most linguists are unaware of its mythological nature. So, that is an important point. We do not need to know exactly what the first mammal was like. We don't need to have a fossil record of every single little step between that mammal and the raccoon to understand that there is a such thing as the mammalian family, that there are certain relationships, and to know that that proto-mammal existed, and even to have a certain idea of what that mammal would have been like. We happen to know that proto-mammal was a kind of a small, smelly, shrew-like thing that was running away from dinosaurs. We have that in the record. But actually, even if we didn't know that, we could reconstruct something like that from looking at what mammalian record we have before those creatures came along. So, okay, that's nice. But then we get back to this tick business, and we really think about what we're doing. And what we have to think about is that languages often have chance resemblances between words that are always kind of cute and kind of funny, and it's often quite a few of them, and you have to be able to distinguish the accident from what actually has some sort of historical meaning. So, for example, Japanese, which is spoken in Japan, and English are not related in any serious way. No one is exactly sure what Japanese is related to. It might be related to the Altaic family that includes Turkish and Mongolian. And if Japanese is part of that, then so is Korean. But we're not sure, and it's a distant relationship. Japanese is not only on an island by itself, but linguistically, it is kind of an oddity. And then English, we've learned, is part of Indo-European. So no close relationship, nor have they been geographically contiguous. To the extent that there's been any exchange, it's been rather recently because of technology and because of travel. But in terms of the gut bucket levels of the language, there's no relationship. And yet, in Japanese, mo means more, just like mo, more. Like that, so. Well, we have so, like just so. Sagaru is to hang down. Sagaru, we have sag. Nai is not. We could guess that that word nai means not, because it sounds kind of like our not or our na or something like that. Mono is a thing, a single entity. Mono, mano, so mano and one. Miru is to see. Mirror. So if we're going to have this relationship between one and finger and only, well, then what about seeing and the fact that you see in a mirror? Miru. Taberu is to eat. Well, it sounds kind of like a Japanese person saying table. Taberu, eat, and you eat at a table, so maybe there's some sort of relationship. Hot in Japanese is atsui. So atsui. If you watch a Japanese person wringing their hands and going, atsui, you don't have to wonder, because not only the wringing of the hands after they burnt themselves, but also just atsui sounds kind of like hot. And hito is a man. Well, he. We have he, and he's are generally men. There's a little emphatic particle, yo, in Japanese. You listen to Japanese people speaking, and you'll often hear that yo at the end of things. Blah, 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 da, yo, yo, yo. Well, we have yo. Emphatic particle. Maybe there's a relationship. Ku is to feed your face. It's often used referring to men shoving, I guess, sushi into their mouths. Ku sounds kind of like our chu, chu, and so on. You could go on and on and on with this in Japanese. It's kind of like a little game. You can do that between a lot of languages. And so, for example, the words, what is it? Fai in Thai means fire. Tai in Thai means tire. Rim in Thai means rim. All of those things by accident. And so, you always have those little things to deal with. So if you're looking at all of this tick business, the fact is that we can assume that between the world's 6,000 languages, there are going to be these accidental resemblances in certain cases. You can look at tick and you can think, well, there you go, there must be something going on. But of course, that tick thing, or something that sounds a little different, like dig or talk or talk or all these other things, those things are just one of course, tens of thousands of words in all of these languages. So how do we know that we're not dealing with a big conglomeration of hitos and yos and taberus and things like that? So it's something that one has to think about. A language can only have so many kinds of syllables in the end. Some languages allow more kinds than others. Some languages have more consonant clusters. Some languages can have more vowels together. But there's no language where you can have 16 consonants at a time. There's a limit. And there's no language where you can have 7 vowels just running after each other. There's a certain general template where consonants and vowels kind of do a little dance together, and there are only so many sounds that the mouth can make. The clicks expand it, but most languages don't make use of those clicks. So eventually, you're going to coalesce on certain T's and P's and da's and K's. That's what you would expect. The issue is whether that happens enough for a pattern to be there. And if we have cases like English and Japanese, which are normal, then the eyeballing strategy, where you're thinking, well, this looks kind of like this, and this looks kind of like that, and it means something kind of like this, the accumulation of this might not be good science. And that's something that a lot of linguists have argued. But to look a little bit more closely at how these things go, there are also some outright data problems. So one way of going about this for them is to look at data from hundreds of languages. And to their credit, it is hundreds. They don't just look at 16. They Greenberg in particular. As a graduate student, I remember one of the main things that he used to do. You used to see him. He got older and older, but he would always be going to Green Library, and he would always have this big stack of grammars, and he'd be going through them. And that's what he did. That's not something that most linguists today are trained to do or would be inclined to do. Often you'd be looking for a grammar yourself for some project you were doing, and it wouldn't be there. And you could almost guess who else would want a description of this language but Greenberg. And you could go up to his table and find it in the stack. So these people were diligent, and Merritt Rulin does the same thing. But it's not just a matter of looking at hundreds of languages at a time. These people are responsible. The idea is to look at the proto-languages. So just like with Indo-European, you go to Sanskrit, and people who are Indo-Europeanists are really into their Sanskrit and their Old Church Slavonic, which is the earliest Slavic language that we know. And you go a lot from them rather than from looking at French and looking at Hindi. You want to start as far back as possible because we know what those languages were like. In the same way, ideally, proto-world people look at proto-languages. So the idea is to look at proto-Indo-European or proto-Austronesian, etc., and to try to trace back to the original language from there, because presumably there would be less distance between these proto-languages and the original one. But then when you look at the proto-language data, there's some problems. And so, for example, the word for water in this little proto-world collection is acqua. That's a little suspicious anyway. That's practically what it is in Italian now. Why would it stay the same? They've never answered that question. Why in Italy would this one word stay the same? Is it because of the sun there? You know, is it because the Roman Empire was successful? You know, is it because they have good food and so they value their water? Obviously, there's no reason. As soon as you know that the proto form is acqua, to me, I know that's wrong. It's certainly not going to be that. But let's pretend that it was. So they have taken 12 proto languages and they have come up with all of the roots that would have been water. And Rulin is rhetorically good, and at one point he says that if the untutored person, I don't remember whether he says a Martian or an untutored person, looked at these 12 forms, they would figure out that the proto-world form was acqua. But then you actually look at the forms. The forms are the following, and all you have to do is listen to them. Ka, ngi, engi, acqua, let's a. Niru, akka, okka, namao, oho, gugu, akwa. Those are the forms, and you can look at all 12 of them on the page. Now, really, a lot of these things don't sound anything like akwa. Nki does not sound like it to me. Gugu sounds like water gurgling, I suppose, but that doesn't sound like akwa to me, just because g is kind of like k. There are only so many sounds. Niru, to me, doesn't sound like anything. And so they're not that alike, and you might think that k-ah is one of them. But all of this is kind of stretching it. But to give them their due, out of all of these proto-language forms, there are four of them which are oddly similar, and that is the ones that are akwa, 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 and ok-a. And that last one, that's a very difficult sound to make. But you look at these and you think, well, that is similar. Now, any linguist who looks at those four forms and says, well, that just must be an accident, is not thinking very hard. No, it's not an accident. And so why do those four look so alike? Well, actually, as it turns out, akwa, akwa, and okwa are from Proto-Indo-European, and we can understand how in Proto-Indo-European it might be akwa, and then a family called Afro-Asiatic and another one called Caucasian. Afro-Asiatic is a big, fat family. For our purposes, suffice it to say that it includes Semitic, which includes Hebrew and Arabic. It also includes some languages of North Africa and some languages of Ethiopia. But for our purposes, Semitic. And those are languages which are rubbing up cheek by jowl with Indo-European languages, and particularly would have been when Indo-European had not spread to Western Europe and into India. Then there are Caucasian languages which are spoken in the Caucasus Mountains. They're small languages. They're so complex, many of them, that I think it's cruelty to children to make them learn them, but they've been doing it for thousands of years. And they're very interesting. They're also near the Indo-European languages. And so wouldn't it be typical that these language families might share words? As we'll see later in the series, borrowing is part of how languages work. And so it could be that these words are so similar because of that. Once you step away from there, you're getting these Nirus and these Gugus, which really are not similar in any way that you would have noticed unless you were trying very hard to make a case that there was some sort of proto-word Akwa. And so there's only one other one, other than these that are all clustered in the Fertile Crescent Middle East region, and that's Akwa. And that one is reconstructed as a proto-form for all the languages. This is the Native American languages of North America. And one really hates to call somebody on something like this because it could be an oversight, and who wants to be called on oversight? It could be a falsification of data, in which case, who wants to be called on that? I genuinely don't know. But that is not a reconstructed form for all of North America, because there exists no such thing. That is a reconstructed form just for Algonquian, and Algonquian is one of many, 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 many groups in Native America. And so this is just a mistake. It's just Algonquian. What about all those other families that are in North America? So Akwa and Algonquian, okay, accidents happen if that really is the form, but there are all these other things. If you look at the other Native American languages, the best that has been done by these the people making this argument is that there's like Uk in one of them, and then there's Yok-Ha in another, there's Aha in another, Ku'u, Yagup, Ukumi, Ohi, and the idea being that all of that sounds kind of like Akwa. But this isn't how you really come up with a relationship that really stands as a solid case. Some of these things you couldn't argue. If I say, it seems to me that Aha doesn't really sound that much like Akwa to me, then somebody else can say, well, it sounds like it to me, and there you go. That's not science. It's not close enough. And in the meantime, a lot of these things don't mean water. They tend to mean things like it's snowing, or winter, or lake, or slippery, and all these things where you can be thinking kind of like, it's kind of like water, but that's not science. So these are the sorts of problems that one finds, and there is a kind of cottage industry of beating on these people for their theories. And some of it is based on these kinds of problems, and I think it might be said that to an extent there's a lumper-splitter issue, and this is always a problem in sciences, and particularly taxonomic sciences, which linguistics partly is. There is a kind of linguist, a historical linguist, who makes their career taking some small group of languages, often that none of us have ever heard of who are not linguists, and trying to trace back what the proto-language would have been. There'll be this diligent, brilliant person who is examining some languages spoken in Vietnam by 500 people at a time, taking down word lists, maybe writing a grammar. You've got about five of them, and then you gather all the grammars and dictionaries that missionaries have done over the past century and a half. Based on that, you do the whole Snusos thing, and you reconstruct, well, the original form in the Western Banaric branch of the Mon Khmer language family must have been this, and that's your dissertation. And the idea is that we're going to do this, and then once we have these sub-proto-languages, we're going to go back to the proto-language for each family, and eventually we'll get to a certain point. And for many of these people, they say that once you get beyond what you can come up with the languages that are living today and anything that we've got in writing from the past, we should just stop because we can't know. Now, the truth is that it's hard to avoid the impression that for many of these people, the goal is less any sincere interest in getting back to proto-ancestral languages in any real way. What they enjoy is the work of reconstructing within their little area. That kind of work is massive fun, but you can do that without having any particular interest in figuring out what the grand family you're working within is related to. It's very natural. Those people are the splitters, and that is the kind of person that a card-carrying historical linguist tends to be. Greenberg and Ruhlin are lumpers. To be sitting in the library and looking through all these grammars, no matter how good you are, no matter how smart you are, you cannot be very familiar with any but a few of those languages. Inevitably, you're going to make some shallow judgments in terms of what a form really means, how it's related, how the sound system distorts it. And you know that deep down, but you can't be an expert on 500 languages, and you're interested in the larger picture, as people should be. So you're doing your best. You know there are going to be some mistakes, but you figure that you're going to find some sort of truth in being this kind of lumper. And inevitably, with that kind of person, there's going to be a little bit of, well, it looks like it. And, well, it does look like it. And often, if it looks like it, then it turns out that they really did come from the same thing. You're not necessarily wrong. And so you put forth your theory. Well, for the people who are splitters, this looks hideously irresponsible. Because inevitably, there are going to be these little mistakes that are made that might not actually impact the larger picture, but they look bad. They have a bad smell. And then there you are in the New York Times and in the Atlantic looking like some kind of hero. And you, who are reconstructing these Aboriginal languages' ancestor, well, the Atlantic is not going to come a calling for you. You know, Tom Wolfe is not going to put you in any of his novels. And so you're a little ticked off. I can understand that. And so there is a deep contempt for this kind of work in the academy. And then on the other hand, the media tend to accept it a little bit too uncritically. So I'm trying to strike the balance for that here. And in the next lecture, we're going to see some other things that these people have been doing, which I think are more promising than many of my colleagues would at least admit in public.